Today's guest says that childhood emotional neglect, CEN, can have a profound influence on how you feel about yourself and the decisions that you make. But what exactly is CEN? We'll find out in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and very pleased to introduce you to today's guest, Dr. Jonice Webb, who is the author of Running on Empty and Running on Empty No More. Dr. Webb, welcome.
Hi, Dr. Brewer. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Webb, just by way of introduction to the audience, I'd like to let them know that you are a licensed psychologist, having worked in a variety of different settings, including a psychiatric emergency service, a substance abuse service, and you've also been the director of several large outpatient clinics. At what point, so clearly you have a great deal of clinical experience, at what point did you begin to recognize what you are defining as the impact, the existence, and the impact of childhood emotional neglect?
It was after I had left the jobs that you just described and started my own private practice, and I began seeing, you know, one client after another in my office, and, you know, seeing a lot of very different types of folks with different types of problems. And there, this pattern started to emerge among my patients, and I started to just see it in many, many of my patients. It was a combination of a certain number of struggles that just were very difficult for my clients to describe, but which were really troubling them quite a bit. It was this sort of deep sense of being out of place and different than other people, and a feeling of just a tendency to be hard on themselves, angry at themselves, and there's more. I won't go into it all right now, but I started getting curious about what was the cause of this, and of course I started looking to see what all these people had in common, because they seemed so disparate, and what I discovered was that they had all grown up with childhood emotional neglect. And at that point, I realized, oh, this is big. This affects a lot of people, and I need to start talking about it.
What's your sense of how it is that it was in your private practice when this came more into full focus for you, given that you had such a rich clinical history prior to going into private practice? Were these a different diagnostic category of folks, or what was going on?
That's a really great question. I think it was because I was, in a way, my clients were more similar to each other. They were mostly, you know, pretty healthy people. And because they were more healthy, I was able to see underneath better, because I wasn't trying to just, like, you know, treat a really severe depression or an addiction or a family with a lot of problems that was, you know, sometimes you can get caught up in a lot of florid, really obvious stuff, and then you miss the subtle. So this is all very subtle, and which is why it's been untalked about for so long. And it, I had to be working with people that allowed me to see them at that level and get to know them at that level.
You say that it's subtle. What is it about childhood emotional neglect that has it showing up in such a subtle way? And I say that with the recognition that with sexual abuse and physical abuse, certainly, you know, after a while, you can kind of spot that without even someone identifying that as having been a history. What makes this different and so subtle?
Well, it's interesting because abuse of any kind, so the way I describe it is abuse is like, you know, if we apply this to a plant instead of a child, abuse is like knocking the plant off of a table. And emotional neglect is more like failing to water it quite enough day after day after day after day, so it stays alive, but it just kind of never flourishes and always feels kind of parched and, well, not that plants feel, but you know what I mean. It just doesn't flourish and grow into what it should be. So maybe I should define what childhood emotional neglect is so it will make more sense.
Perfect.
Okay. So childhood emotional neglect is a parent's failure to respond enough to the child's emotional needs. And that's all it is. So it can be even loving, non-abusive, caring parents. It can be parents who are trying their best all the way to the other end of the continuum. It can be abusive parents as well. But all it takes is for the parents to not be noticing the child's feelings enough and not be responding to the child's feelings enough. And what this does is it gives the child a subliminal message, which is even more powerful because it's usually never stated outright. But the message is your feelings are irrelevant and or they're not welcome in your childhood home. So when a child hears this message, he has to adapt, and he just naturally pushes his feelings down in a way and then grows into an adulthood without complete, full, healthy access to his own emotions.
You know, when you add the word enough to it, it really does kind of turn, or at least it can turn it into a bit of a sticky wicket. What is acknowledging, attending to the child's feelings enough? Because it could be different for every child.
Yes, definitely, it can.
So how do you determine what's enough? As a parent listening, how does, let's say of an infant, how does the parent determine what is enough?
By watching the child's emotions, because the emotions are the tell-all sign for every kid. If a child's emotions are being, even an infant, not that infants really have emotions in the same way as adults, because they're just strictly wiring at that point, but they still matter. So a child, and even an infant, that whose needs, emotional needs, are being met, you'll be able, you know, as a parent, you'll feel connected to that child. You feel like you understand the child. You'll feel like even though there are conflicts, you always come back together. You'll feel like you understand your child's behavior, because for all of us, our behavior is driven by our feelings. And so if you understand the child's feelings, you understand the kid. So there is just a certain sense of being connected and the child just thriving that happens when emotional connection is there and there's enough from the parents.
For those who sort of grew up hearing that you should not attend, now I'm talking about infants, you should not respond to your child every time he or she cries. That sometimes you should just let that go and you need to kind of learn the difference between the crying. Is that an example of paying good enough attention to the child's emotional sense of self?
I wouldn't say yes or no to that, because I think it depends so much on the parents and on the child. But, you know, it's not like a child's every emotion should be catered to. You know, sometimes people misunderstand what I'm saying that way, but it's not that. It's just noticing and being aware. If you hear your infant crying, but you know exactly why the infant is crying, or you're pretty sure you know, because you've paid attention and you've observed your child and you understand your child, you might make a decision it's best not to go in for a while. And that might be your best guess based on really understanding your child. And even if you're wrong, it's not emotional neglect. I mean, we all make mistakes. We all are parenting by the seat of our pants. We all have to figure this stuff out, and it's so hard. So there's no perfect parent, and that's okay. It's just about paying attention, trying to understand the child's feelings, showing the child that you see her feelings, and giving a response to them, which does not mean indulging them.
So clearly, you're not saying that everybody has to be a perfect parent, which, you know, I know you know that for young parents, especially first-time parents, that's what they're striving to be, is the perfect parent. But that's not what we're talking about at all.
No. There's nothing about perfection here. It's just about your mindset. So if your mindset is, I care what my child is feeling, and I'm going to pay attention to that and try to understand, and you stick with that mindset, you're doing a really good job. The thing that makes it hard for parents is if they grew up with parents who were emotionally neglected and who didn't pay attention to their feelings. So this is how emotional neglect transfers from one generation to another. If you grow up with parents who weren't paying attention to your feelings, then you don't pay attention to your own feelings as an adult, which is part of the whole syndrome. Mm-hmm. And then you're blind to your child's emotions without even realizing it.
You give an example of several different kinds of parenting styles, if you will, that can end up with a child feeling empty. And I wanted to go over just a couple of them. The bereaved parent, the divorced or widowed parent, what happens with that parent that can translate into neglect, emotional neglect of the child?
Well, first of all, I want to say that not all bereaved children or what was the other kind you said?
Bereaved parents or parents who are divorced.
Or depressed.
Parents who are divorced or widowed.
Right. So there's no category of parent that automatically results in childhood emotional neglect. But these are just, I try to put the parents into categories to help people be able to see their own parents. But if a parent, let's say the parent has CEN, and the parent themselves, because they grew up with parents not paying attention to their feelings, and then they're divorced or widowed, they will not understand or be able to see, through no fault of their own, what their child is going through emotionally, and is really, it's just a setup to under-respond in a very difficult situation. And that parent may be just struggling to keep his head above water and working very hard and having to do two jobs. I call them struggling parents, which are the bereaved, divorced, widowed, depressed, or one with a special needs family member. These parents have lots of reasons for their attention to be pulled elsewhere. And so they're just more at risk for not noticing their child's emotions and not responding to them enough.
And it certainly underscores how it would be if they themselves experienced childhood emotional neglect. It really makes it clear how they could pass that on to their own children with, as you say, without even realizing it.
Exactly. It's not even their fault. They're trying. They just don't. Right. There's just this big piece of the pie that they don't know exists.
If you don't know how to understand or notice your own feelings, you're going to have a hard time teaching that to somebody else.
Exactly, which brings up the issue of emotion skills, like how to know what you're feeling, how to put words to that, how to decide whether you need to share that with someone and how to do that, how to communicate about what you're feeling or what you think someone else is feeling. All of those are skills that you don't get to learn well enough if you grow up with emotional neglect. And that sends you into adulthood with some things missing that you really need.
Talk for a moment about the sociopathic parent. What's going on there?
Sociopathic parents are in my type 3 category, which are the self-involved parents. These are parents who are narcissistic, who are authoritarian, who are addicted, or, as you say, the sociopathic parent. So the sociopathic parent in particular is one who has a sociopathic personality. And there's a really great book about that called The Sociopath Next Door by Dr. Martha Stout. And it talks about the sociopathic personality and how there are so many just all over the place in today's world. And we don't see them because they know how to hide themselves and act like they're just, you know, regular people. But the sociopath, what sets the sociopath apart is that they have no capacity for guilt. So that frees them up to do pretty much anything. And a sociopathic parent can end up being extremely controlling and hurtful, and sometimes even taking joy out of harming the child, out of, you know, emotionally harming the child at least, out of retribution, or just like enjoying manipulating the child. I think that's the hardest, definitely one of the hardest kind of parents to grow up with.
One of the most painful ones to grow up with, surely.
Yes, yes. Terrible.
All right, let's look at some of the expressions of emotional neglect. You talk about the feeling of emptiness. Is there a way to describe that so someone listening really gets a handle on what that means?
Yeah, it's interesting because I put that word to it because I heard so many people telling me that they felt like something, like a hole inside of them, or like something was missing inside of them, or sometimes it was physical and they felt it in their belly, you know, off and on, or in some people feel it in their chest, or some people feel it in their throat, or it's just this sort of numbness. It's just a nothing, like a feeling of the absence of something, like just a nothing feeling. A lot of people describe it, and they all put different words to it, but what it really comes down to is just feeling empty. And what I've realized over time is that they feel empty because they have the most deeply personal biological expression of who they are, which is their own emotions, walled off behind a wall. And they can feel that that is missing. And they're just living life without that very rich resource that the rest of us rely on.
What about counterdependence? We're used to hearing the term codependent. What does counterdependence mean, and how does it connect to the experience of CEN?
Counterdependence is different than codependence, although it sort of plays in. It's literally just a fear of depending on anyone. And so emotionally neglected children are at risk of growing up with this fear of depending on other people because they knew deep down on some level when they were growing up for their entire childhood that they could not rely on their parents emotionally. And they probably experienced in young childhood a number of times when they went to their parents emotionally and their parents either failed them in some way or turned them away, some or perhaps even shamed them. And so they have a fear of ever being rejected in that painful way again. And they learned the lesson, don't rely on anyone, from those experiences. And it really sets you up to be afraid to go to anyone or expect anyone to come through for you.
It certainly can have a huge impact on who you allow yourself to be in relationships with, given your expectations. Dr. Webb, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue our conversation. Webb, what role does guilt and shame play in the lives of the emotionally neglected child turned adult?
The child's when you grow up with emotional neglect, you don't really have an adult who's paying attention to when you feel, when you make a mistake and are upset with yourself, which is the sort of natural way that we all feel when we make a mistake. And so without a parent who is walking you through that and saying, okay, so here's what happened, here's the choice you made, here's how it went wrong, let's figure out how to fix this so we can learn from it and move forward. The child is missing, I call it the voice of compassionate accountability from the parent that we internalize when we get that enough as a child. If your parents weren't paying attention enough to notice how badly you felt when you felt when you made a mistake, then you tend to, a lot of children just naturally feel, you know, they take it very hard, and they, this voice gets set up in their head, that their heads, that puts them down and can even become kind of insulting, like, well, that was really stupid, why would you do something like that? And if your parents actually said that to you, the voice is going to be even stronger. But even if they never say it, but they just never teach you how to learn from your mistakes and move on, you're going to be set up with a tendency to treat yourself that way. And the other part of it is that childhood emotional neglect is so invisible and unmemorable, because when you grow up this way, excuse me, generally you don't realize it. You don't remember things that your parents didn't notice or didn't ask you or didn't say. And so you might look back and say, well, geez, I had a great childhood. I had everything. My parents loved me. They had a, gave me a nice house. I went to a good school. And you see everything you had. You can't see what you didn't get. And whatever problems you have as an adult and all of these sort of secret struggles that you're coping with make you feel like there's something wrong with you and you should have done better. You know, I had such a great childhood. Why am I not happier? That kind of thing. And that sets up shame and self-directed anger as well. So there's definitely a tendency for people who grow up this way to blame themselves and be angry at themselves and have a harsh voice inside for their own mistakes.
When you wrote Running on Empty, you brought to our awareness and understanding what childhood emotional neglect is. In Running on Empty No More, you then begin to talk about essentially recovery, if you will. If you grow up with the sense that you don't really have a sense of what your emotional makeup is, but you're an adult now, and let's say you're married with children, does it really matter? Do you really have to recover?
Well, if you want to have a connected and rich life, you do. You can definitely live with CEN your whole life, and many, many people do. I just want people to get an idea of what they might be missing if they do that. So in my first book, it's really the second half of the book is all about recovering yourself from CEN. And then my second book I wrote because as people were working on themselves, they started to see their relationships differently. They started to realize that they were not only ignoring their own emotions their whole lives, but they were ignoring also their spouse's or their partner's emotions, and that their relationships were missing something. And they also would see their parenting through a different lens. And I was getting so many messages from people saying, how do I make sure I don't pass this down to my children? And, you know, my children are adults now, and they're very distant from me. And now I'm doing this work on myself, but I don't know how to try to reach them. What should I do? And also, people start to see their own parents differently because they see, oh, so this is what happened. it's not just that I was born flawed, it's that there was something real that didn't happen for me that I needed as a child, and it was my own parents who failed me in this way. And it's hard to blame parents for this, especially if they're well-meaning parents. And, you know, they don't really deserve blame, but the question is, what do you do with that? Once you see it, you're kind of stuck with it. And it can make you feel really awkward, or can make you angry at your parents, or uncomfortable when you're with them. And I wanted to address all of those questions about how it affects your life once you realize that you've grown up with CEN and start to heal it.
When you are first aware of the fact that CEN is something that you have grown up with, childhood emotional neglect, is there an overwhelming, is there the potential for an overwhelming sense of anger and loss? Do sometimes people feel like, oh, this is way too much information for me to work on?
You know, it's really interesting. I think it does affect some people that way. The people that I hear from are people who feel an incredible sense of relief. So many people say, I finally understand what's been wrong with me all this time. I never knew. And one of the effects of childhood emotional neglect that we didn't touch on was that this feeling, I call it the fatal flaw. It's this deep feeling like something is just wrong with me. And once you recognize that CEN has been at work in your life, you can let go of that feeling and that flaw, and your self-blame is sort of freed up, and you start to feel like, okay, now I have an explanation. Now here are the things that I can do to fix this. And it can be incredibly freeing.
So you become aware of the fact that what you thought was indeed a fatal flaw, in fact, was something that you learned from your parents in part out of their own lack of awareness.
Yep, exactly.
Which kind of gives you some space between how could you do this to me and having a genuine relationship with your parent. But let's say that you have a parent, again, who has grown up having experienced childhood emotional neglect and not become aware of its existence and how to heal, while you, as the adult, you're working on your healing. How does that relationship now connect up, or does it?
Yeah, that can be a really tough situation. And so part of what I'm trying to answer in this second book is what to do with that and how to decide whether, you know, some people should try to talk to their parents about this, especially if you have well-meaning parents or parents who were struggling, you know, the bereaved or the parents who were just, you know, financially challenged while you were growing up and had to really, you know, work several jobs, or parents who meant well and didn't do this out of being too self-focused, really sometimes can feel relieved when their adult child reaches out to them if you do it in the right way. And, you know, it's really important to address guilt, because everyone will end up feeling guilty. It's hard because you don't want to say to your parents, you failed me, but you do need to convey that in a way. So it's a little touchy in terms of deciding whether to try to talk to your parents, and then if so, how to go about it.
Can you give us an example of a way that perhaps one person went about it, recognizing that what works for one may not work for anybody else but that one?
Yes. I can give you an example of one of my, well, I'll just tell you about someone.
Okay.
So it was parents who really had just grown up with childhood emotional neglect themselves, and both parents had the full picture of CEN themselves, and they had done their very best to raise their child, but, you know, with this one vital ingredient just glaringly missing. And as this man began to understand what was wrong with him and started to heal himself, he started noticing that he was feeling very angry at his parents every time he saw them. And then he started not really wanting to see them. And they started feeling hurt, like he was avoiding them, and he wasn't giving them any explanation for that. They sort of started pursuing him and calling him more, but never asking him what was wrong, because that would be too, you know, too personal and too emotional for them. They just weren't capable of that. So he ended up just casually stopping by their house at a time when he normally would have before all this started, and began asking them some questions about their own childhoods, and sort of got them talking about how they grew up. And while they were talking, he looked for opportunities to point out how their parents were unavailable for them. And as he did that, the parents, in the first meeting, he didn't get really far. He just sort of got them to explain, to tell some stories, and he was able to say, wow, where was, you know, Granddad when that was happening? Didn't he notice? And the parents actually got a tear the dad got a tear in his eye when this man said this to his father. And if you start small and then just sort of keep at it, oftentimes asking about their childhoods and trying to bring emotion into the conversation very gradually can really work. So that's just an example of one possible way to do it. And it just depends so much on how, you know, what kind of parents you have and how comfortable you can feel approaching them. Eventually, this guy asked his parents to read my first book, Running on Empty, and the mother had no reaction at all and never mentioned it, but the father actually did talk with him about it, and they had a conversation, and his relationship with his father changed after that.
It's hard to imagine someone reading your first book and having no reaction at all, which sort of really, in my mind, would speak at least in part to the severity of the childhood emotional neglect that mother experienced as a little one.
Yes. I mean, it is amazing how many people can read that book and it's sort of like they just can't absorb it because they just don't have the groundwork for it, or maybe it's too threatening. You know, you have to be in the right state of mind to take all this in. It helps to be looking for answers. And, you know, then you feel like you've found answers. But if you're not looking for answers and you sort of don't want to go there because that's just not what you do, then it can just, you know, bounce off of you.
Well, and your first book, Running on Empty, I can certainly see how, if that's not where you are, then, you know, I would imagine that in some respects, your eyes and your spirit would almost glaze over what they were reading in Running on Empty. Do you recommend that folks read Running on Empty first prior to picking up a copy of Running on Empty No More?
I wrote the second book. I wrote it so that you don't have to read the first book.
Okay.
But so I think if you've recognized, if you're curious about childhood emotional neglect because of your relationships and you see it there first, you could read the second book first. But I think it does really help to go back and read the first book too, because it would fill in a lot of a lot of information.
When you grow up, having had the experience of CEN, what kind of impact does that have on your adult relationships, or more specifically on your adult partner selection?
Yeah. When you grow up with your feelings pushed away in this way, it kind of sets you up to have a hard time choosing your partner. And what most people end up doing who have CEN is there are a few different mistakes that you can be predisposed to. One would be that you have this emptiness inside of you. And the problem with that emptiness is that it naturally makes you want to fill it. So you feel like something's missing, and it can make you feel too intense of a need to partner with somebody. So it can cause you to make a commitment to someone too soon before you really understand them or know them well enough. And the thing about emotion is that it's so helpful. It informs us about who we should choose as a partner. And, you know, if you think about your partner choice or your spouse choice, it starts with feelings. But the problem with that is that feelings can be very intense very quickly, you know, that when you first meet someone, you have all those brain chemicals going. If you don't understand that that's what's going on and you don't wait long enough to have some conflicts with them and work through some problems, you can end up with someone that's not at all who you thought it would be. And a couple of other things that you can end up doing is feel very desperate to never appear needy, because this is the counterdependence. So if you're a very counterdependent person, it can be very terrifying to think of appearing that you want to meet a partner. So I think there are a lot of CEN people who just never can open themselves up to a real relationship, so they end up never really having one.
Given that some of the features of CEN include your own sense of guilt and shame, your own ability to judge yourself more harshly than others, and your own tendency to want to feel completely independent of others, does that make you more at risk to be in an abusive relationship with your partner? Are you more likely to choose an abusive person?
I don't think, I haven't really seen that so much, but what I have seen is a tendency to choose someone who has a big personality or someone who is really all about themselves. Because when you have CEN, you know, your feelings are pushed away and you tend to be all about other people's needs and trying to fulfill other people's needs because you're not paying attention to your own. And that can make you an attractive target to a narcissistic person who is looking for someone with no needs, so it can be all about them. So it can set you up to partner with someone who takes up all the space. And, you know, that can feel kind of fine for a while, but it wears thin over time, needless to say.
Absolutely. And it can also, I would imagine, set you up to be with someone who has experienced emotional neglect themselves.
Exactly. Okay. Yes, it's interesting because I do a lot of couples therapy, and I can really tell when I get a couple who both grew up with CEN, it's just this feeling like they could have been married 30 years and they're so distant from each other because their emotions are just not in the relationship.
Interesting. Dr. Webb, yeah. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to focus on sharing with the audience what kind of skills you actually need to be in that loving, emotionally connected relationship that persons who've experienced childhood emotional neglect may not even know to look for or to anticipate. So that's where we'll pick up when we begin. Folks, don't go away. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Thank you.
Dr. Webb, how can one tell whether or not they're in a relationship with someone who's experienced CEN?
You can tell because, well, it can be difficult, but good signs to look for are if you feel like your partner is kind of unavailable emotionally, and your partner tries to avoid talking about problems or gets really just tongue-tied or shut down when if you share your own emotions or bring up a problem. So it's sort of if your partner lacks the skills to or the emotional awareness to deal with problems, if you feel kind of lonely in the relationship, if you feel like you can't really get much closer to the person and you feel like you want to, those are also signs. The classic thing that a CEN partner will do is if you bring up a problem, they will say, they'll look for a quick fix, a quick answer, or they'll change the subject and just hope that you forget it, or they'll take it very personally and sort of overreact to it, you know, hear it as a much bigger criticism than it really is. Or they'll just get tongue-tied and not be able to deal with it at all. So I think if you see any of those signs in your partner, that would lead you to question.
So how can one tell if one is in fact in an emotionally connected relationship? Let's say that you grew up with CEN, you've been working on it, and now you're thinking, you know, maybe you've kind of got things together in a different way. What's the relationship now going to look like?
It would be just a long period of time going by where you're you go through phases where sometimes you feel really happy and comfortable together, and then there will be an eruption, some kind of a conflict or a fight, and you'll talk it through, and you'll either resolve it or you'll decide to put it to the side, and then you'll go on. And through all of that, you'll just keep feeling closer and closer to the other person. If fights just tear you down because you can't resolve them, that's a sign that communication is breaking down, or you're not a good match, of course, is always a possibility. But when you're really doing it right, you know what you're feeling, and you're able to tell what your partner is feeling, and you're able to talk about that with each other, and you're able to say difficult things to each other, and without, you know, shutting down or flying into a rage or getting defensive, and you're able to work through problems together.
So, in fact, it sounds like you're able to achieve a much, much more intimate relationship.
Exactly. Emotional intimacy is key to a healthy relationship, and it's really hard to have it when you have CEN that you've never worked on.
What do you do if you're, as an adult, you're working through this, but your parents are still saying things that are harmful, hurtful to you, aren't interested in taking a look at their behavior, just aren't interested in the kind of conversation we've been having at all? What do you do then? Do you continue to try? Do you pull back and withdraw from the relationship, which is very hard for many people? What do you do?
Is this a parent or a partner you're talking about?
I'm talking about, a parent. If you are the adult child and your parent is just continuing to say and do hurtful, harmful things, continuing to behave the way that they behaved as you were growing up, what do you do with that?
Right. So there are a few different options. One, it depends if you feel like you want to, you know, one option is just distance from them, which is what most people end up doing. And that's always an option. And I always say, if you have a parent who keeps hurting you, that's not okay. and you have every right to distance yourself from them. And in fact, you should if you need to do that in order to grow yourself. But some people feel like they would like to, it's easier for them to distance if they first try to convey to their parent what's going wrong and why they're distancing. So, and I have an example of that in my new book about how that goes for one woman. But you can communicate to your parent, here's exactly why I don't feel comfortable around you, and here's exactly what you say that hurts my feelings, and I've tried to talk with you about this, I've tried to ask you not to do this, and you're just not interested, so I have no other option but to distance, to see you less or talk with you less. And then at least you've put it out there and you've made it clear to your parents what's going on. But you don't have to do that. That's only if it helps you in some way.
So if you don't feel as though you can communicate with your parent in a way that they're going to hear what you're saying, not necessarily agree, but just hear it, then you don't have to say anything at all. You can just choose to withdraw, and that's okay.
That is absolutely right. I think one of the biggest mistakes that people make is staying around abusive or hurtful parents, sacrificing themselves in the process. Because you really, being around an abusive or hurtful parent, it just damages a person. It doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman or a 40-year-old or an 18-year-old or a 60-year-old. It's very damaging, and it will just make it very hard to continue to grow as a human being as long as that's happening to you.
And I think about the parent who's hurtful to you is not going to be all that warm and fuzzy with any of your children.
Usually not, although it's kind of interesting. Some hurtful parents can be very loving with their grandchildren. Excuse me. And I really don't understand that myself, but I see it a lot.
And are do they continue to be loving as the child grows into adulthood? Do you know?
To the grandchild?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think so. I think that sometimes I do see that.
Interesting. You talk about the four-step guilt management technique. What is that?
Well, it's amazing how much guilt comes into setting boundaries with one's parents. Most people, because we're all just sort of born with this natural sense of responsibility to respect and take care of our parents. So doing anything less than that, sorry, I'm having trouble with my voice. Doing anything less than that can make you feel like you're a bad person. So, in order to help people manage that better, I did develop this guilt management technique that you can literally use to make yourself feel more prepared to talk to your parents or set limits with them. And it's really just a process of asking identifying exactly what you actually feel guilty about, trying to figure out what it's due to, and if that guilt is healthy or helpful to you in any way, and trying to, and then just sort of putting it in its place, putting
What
that guilt in its place.
does that mean to put guilt in its place?
If, for example, if you go through this process that I've outlined in my book, and you come to the conclusion that your guilt is based on that message we all get that we're supposed to love and respect our parents no matter what, and that message doesn't really apply to you because your parents give you so little emotional sustenance in life, and in fact are holding you back. And you realize that your guilt is not really being helpful to you. then it really helps you be able to override it and say, okay, yes, I feel guilty. It's not a helpful feeling for me right now. So it's really just handling guilt as you would any other feeling, deciding if it's helpful or not, and deciding whether to follow it or not. And you can make an active decision not to let your guilt rule you. It may not make that feeling go away totally, but you can at least act in a healthy way in spite of it.
So you can practice taking care of yourself in a different way.
Exactly. Yep.
What do you do with the, I would think, the disappointment, the sadness, the anger, the all of those flooding, the flood of feelings that come as you recognize, and perhaps gratefully as you've indicated, but you recognize that you grew up living a less than full life, that even as an adult you're living a less than full life for reasons that truly don't have a lot to do with you?
I think the best thing to do is channel it forward, like channel it into your future. You couldn't know this. And, you know, I think it's really important to know that there are thousands upon thousands or even, you know, who knows how many people out there who have been living the same way because they didn't know either. And if you, you know, you can't fix what you don't know. So now that you know, there, however, there are some things that you can do and there are some ways that you can start to fix this. And I think just identifying a path forward is the thing to do.
What do you say to people who say, oh, I've been like this for 20 years, or, you know, I'm 25 now, it's just not going to be any different, or I'm 45, this is who I am, I'm stuck with it, let's just keep it moving. What do you say to those folks? Is it true that you can be stuck with the results of CEN?
I think it's a personal choice. To some extent, I'm sure there are some people who really grew up with such extreme CEN and are just so, you know, so accustomed to living that way that the idea of changing is just untenable. But I think for the huge majority of people, if you want to heal it, if you want to do the work, it's all laid out for you in these two books. And I also have an online recovery program. And you really can work on this. It takes time and it takes commitment. But I've seen people of all ages recover and, you know, really make a difference in their lives by doing this.
Men and women. Okay.
I also wanted to mention, if people are wondering if they have CEN, since it's so hard to remember, they can go to my website and take the emotional neglect questionnaire that is on there. It's free.
And your website address is?
It's emotionalneglect.com.
All right. And the once one takes the quiz and discovers that they perhaps have been impacted upon by childhood emotional neglect, then reading these books, actually just going through your website and seeing what's there, can be very useful.
Yes, there's a lot of information on my website, for sure.
For those listening now who are perhaps toying with the possibility that maybe this is something that they experienced in their childhood, what do you want them to think about?
I'd like them to think about whether they felt alone as a child on some level, because I think that that is the biggest, it's not even in my quiz, because I think it's something that a lot of people, if they did feel that way, they will remember it in some way. But if you feel alone and you feel kind of disconnected now, and or you felt that as a child, I think that's a really strong sign that this could be happening for you and that it makes sense to look into it further.
All right. Sounds good. Dr. Johnice Webb, author of author of Running on Empty and Running on Empty No More. Thank you so much for joining us today here at Mind Talk, and thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Brewer. I enjoyed it.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications and is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can also download the free Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. You can listen to Mind Talk on iTunes. There are lots of places that you can go to listen to this and all other Mind Talk programs. If you'd like to make a comment or ask a question about today or any other program, please send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's myndtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.